the Mike Tech Show, show number 373. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me suggestions for future show topics or any question. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450. You can follow me on Twitter. Twitter.com/MikeTechShow, and also send me a friend request on Facebook, Facebook.com/MikeTechShow. Well, to kick this show off today, sitting beside me is a friend of mine from a networking organization that you've heard me refer to in the past called BNI, and that's a Business Networking International, and it's a networking event where you have a one profession represented from all kinds of professions, and it's the purpose of generating referrals for each other, and it's how we grow our business. Josh Hummel, who is our business attorney in the organization, and Josh has such great depth of knowledge and certainly has an interest in computers and technology. When we started talking, I mentioned about some of the questions that you've had for me in the past relating to starting businesses and technology and encryption and data. And so I invited Josh to join me on a special edition of the Mike Tech Show. And I give you right now Josh Hummel.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you very much. I'm really glad for the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners today about a variety of legal issues that involve the IT industry. Obviously, technology has come a long way, particularly over the past 10 or 20 years, and as with any growing industry, the field of IT has seen a lot of changes in the law, and will continue to see those changes. Just to provide everyone with a little background about me, I'm a partner in the law firm of Fox Rothschild LLP. Our firm has more than 500 attorneys spread out over 16 different offices in the United States, five in Pennsylvania, three in New Jersey, Connecticut, New York, Delaware, Washington, D.C., Florida, two in California, and one in Las Vegas. My office is located in Bluebell, Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia, pretty close to where Mike does his show. And I primarily represent small and medium-sized businesses in a variety of different matters with a specific focus on civil litigation and lawsuits. And I've had a lot of different clients, some in the IT field, including companies that develop websites, companies that develop software. And I've had many clients, obviously, outside the IT field as well. And in litigation, when you're in the process of compiling information and documents that might be relevant to the case, you also learn about your client's information management system and where they keep all of their relevant documents and information. And so the businesses I've represented are like businesses everywhere in that most of them are using different methods of storing their documents and business information electronically. So I've seen a variety of different systems relating to document and ESI management just as a normal course of representing all kinds of businesses in litigation. I know many of you have submitted questions in advance of today's podcast, and we're going to answer some of those questions today. Feel free to submit questions during the show as well, and we'll try to answer them if we have time. As a general matter, please try and keep your questions general rather than very specific to your particular situation. There are a couple reasons for this. First, I know that people are joining us from all over the United States and perhaps internationally. And I practice law in Pennsylvania. While there are similarities in the laws of many different states, Every state has different variations in the law, so I don't want to profess to know what the law of every state is on a given issue. So I'm going to try and keep this in terms of a general discussion of legal principles. And second, I didn't want to get into really specific questions about someone's business or legal situations. One, I didn't want to broadcast online, specific problems that you may have, or give someone that you may be having a dispute with an advantage of knowing, certain information or strategies. And then two, as any lawyer would probably tell you, there's always exceptions to the rule. Every case is different. Every situation is different. You're going to have specific facts that, and sometimes very important specific facts that affect the answer to a question that may, completely change depending on those circumstances. So if you're dealing with a specific problem or issue, definitely, if it relates to legal issues, you should consult a lawyer about the situation so they can understand all of the facts and issues and advise you on all the potential ramifications of that. So with that in mind, Mike, maybe we can turn to some of the questions that we received in advance of today's show.
Yep.
Just as a side note, as I mentioned before, we've removed some of the more personal information from some of the questions because of the things we just discussed. So go ahead, Mike.
Okay. Hello, Mike. I've been listening to your show for the past few months and find it very informative and helpful. I have a question for your technology law discussion with Josh. But first, a little context to the discussion. I currently work as an engineer. I have been actively supporting a small network of friends and family computers, as well as informally, i.e. unpaid. Supporting the small business networks of several startups I have worked for in the past two decades, I would like to turn my hobby into my career. While I have worked at many startups in the past, I have never started a business myself. And I'm primarily working for this to be a small one-man computer support operation for at least a few years. I've just finished listening to the Mike Tech Show podcast 369, where you discuss consulting agreements and indemnification. My question falls into two parts. One, what sort of legal liability issues does someone in a computer service and support operation face as part of his or her profession, and how would one plan in protection to contracts? Do you want to take that and then I read the second
sure, go,
one?
Or? Go ahead, yeah. Read the...
Okay, the second one is, what are the benefits and challenges of the legal protections offered between a sole proprietorship, a limited liability company, which is LLC, and incorporating in this context? This, I know, is a hot potato on a lot of listeners. And this has come up in actually another podcast that I do many times. So yep. Go ahead.
Thank you. And those are some really great questions, and they touch on a lot of different legal issues. And let's actually address the second one first. What are the benefits and challenges of the legal protections offered between a sole proprietorship, an LLC, and incorporating? This listener has hit on a very important issue in terms of whether to form a business identity, and mm-hmm. for many reasons, a lot of times it is a very good idea to do so. Typically, business entities exist to protect the people associated with them from individual liability that may arise in the conduct of the business. And when there's only you conducting business under your name or as a sole proprietorship, the only one that someone can sue should something go wrong is you. And if you're found to be liable, the assets that could be at risk are your personal assets, your house, car, bank accounts, computers, mm-hmm. hardware, software, your personal belongings, yep. et cetera. When you operate through a business entity, if your business is sued and is found liable, most subject to the attack is the assets and property of the business as opposed to your personal assets. And so business entities can be formed, owned, and operated by a single person. They can buy and sell and hold property. They can enter into contracts. They can be held liable, or they can hold other people liable on certain claims and obligations. And we'll talk about the different types of business entities that you can form in a minute. But whatever type of entity you decide to form, it's important to follow through with the different corporate formalities that businesses should follow. Obviously, you would need to keep your personal assets separate from the company's assets. You would have separate bank accounts and not commingle funds between the two. If you're lending or borrowing money from the company, sorry, I'm not loud enough.
Good.
Get close to the microphone. if you're lending or borrowing money from the company, you need to properly document that. You need to properly document, you know, the salary or distributions that you receive.
Now, do you do that if you're just a sole proprietor? Do you do that and that can help protect you? Or this is only if you are an LLC, or is it both? Or is this a common practice you should do?
Well, for a sole proprietorship, there's really not another entity there.
Okay.
So the assets and business of the company is essentially you. Whereas if you have a different entity, whether it's an LLC or a corporation or a partnership, then you have the assets of the business are separated from your personal assets.
Okay, let's say there's someone who has a sole proprietor that has a separate business account for his business for operating. He still can do that because he needs that for his EIN number. That's the employer identification number, and you have a separate bank account, and you have separate. I mean, it doesn't matter probably from a legal standpoint.
Well, in terms of, you have different, anyone individually or a business can have multiple accounts, that kind
right,
of thing.
Right.
But in terms of, who is the owner of the account, you would have mm-hmm. that bank account as part of your business. But on the other hand, what could a creditor look to get as part of that? Is it going after the business account, or is it going after the person? So, potentially there could be exposure to both in the event of a sole proprietorship.
Now, someone mentioned in the chat here, now a single person can be an LLC. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. That would, why would we want that? Why would you want an LLC over a sole proprietor? When should someone say, wow, I really should consider an LLC?
An LLC is there to basically separate your liabilities from your business liabilities from your personal liabilities. If you have assets that are really not part of your business, your house, your car, things like that. That's the primary thing is in terms of why people form business entities, whether it's an LLC, whether it's a corporation or a partnership. Different types of partnerships. Obviously, there are general partnerships where a partner is generally liable to for the debts and obligations of the other partners. And so there are different other types of companies, LLCs, corporations that exists so that the business is really separated from your personal assets.
So I'm protected. So if I'm out there and I'm an LLC and I'm a computer consultant and I'm out there and I do damage on someone's system,
let's not get into too specific, but does the formation of a business entity necessarily guarantee that you're never
right.
going to be sued personally? No, there's never a
right.
guarantee against
and that's
anything,
what I'm getting
but,
at.
It does help to reduce the risk, that someone's going to go after your personal, again, it's not a guarantee, but, it helps to try and protect what you're doing as part of your business versus what you're doing personally.
So would the recommendation be I guess it depends on the type of business, but I'm trying to think of why you would want to be a sole proprietor. Is there additional expense to get an LLC?
Usually there's some filing fees and things like that you create when you're trying to create a business entity, whether it's a corporation or a partnership or an LLC. There's some people, and I remember one of the questions was in terms of, one of the advantages of a sole proprietorship is just the simplicity of it and that kind of thing. There's generally, I'm not going to give a broad statement as to which type of business would be better for a given person, because there's really a lot of different factors in terms of what type of entity would be right for you, and it's going to depend on a lot of different things, which we can kind of go through. I'll give you kind of the rundown
Let
me just give you, kind of what the difference is between some of these different types of entities.
Mm-hmm.
A corporation is generally the ownership structure is shareholders or stockholders. The corporation raises its money initially by selling stock. Corporations usually created by filing a certificate of incorporation or articles of incorporation with the state, and the corporation will create bylaws and have a board of directors. The board of directors will appoint your officers, your president, vice president, et cetera. And then the officers will usually have employees and things that that run the business. Shareholders would usually be paid by dividends or some kind of distributions or selling their stock in the company. And then you have, as a corporation, there are different types of corporations, S corporations, C corporations, and things like that, mm-hmm. nonprofit corporations and different ones that you designate according to the IRS. And you can have different types of stock that are available as well to a corporation. General partnerships are usually a partnership which could be any association of two or more persons to carry on a business as co-owners. General partners are generally each responsible for all of the obligations of the partnership. General partnerships are usually formed when the partners enter into a written, actually any kind of partnership agreement, preferably in writing, although it doesn't necessarily have to be in some states. The partnership agreement doesn't have to be publicly filed, but if the partnership does a business under a name, you would ordinarily file some kind of a fictitious name registration. And then partners would be paid through distributions, and the agreement will state what the partner's contribution.
Now I'm gonna break it down. That sounds complicated for a lot of people sure. are listening to that, and it sounds very complicated. But you can still go through all that if you are one person, though. You can still go through a whole LLC, or is that only for partnerships?
Partnerships would be two or more people.
You'd have
two or more for partnership. For a corporation, you could have a corporation, usually that would be, you know, at least one person.
Right.
You would have same thing with an LLC. It could be one or more. They're called members, not shareholders. There are different things. So rather than, I guess, go through all of these different ones, I mean, in terms of, you know, picking different entities, you know, the answer to your question is going to be different for every business, and it's going to depend on a lot of things. One, you know, how much are you looking to protect yourself from personal liability, in which case an LLC can be very different from a general partnership, which we just talked about, where partners can be liable for the debts and obligations of the partnership. Two, what kind of exit strategy do the owners of the business want in terms of being able to sell off their ownership interests, and to whom? There may be limitations in terms of which type of entity that you have and your ability to transfer or get out of the ownership. So obviously one of the key considerations might be tax liability. There are different tax advantages and disadvantages for each type of entity. There are a lot of nuances depending on how you want your business to operate from an ownership perspective. And if you're interested in determining what type of business would be best for you, you definitely want to speak with an attorney or an accountant to weigh the different factors as to how you plan to finance and operate your business. Because some of the factors are going to be different going from business to business. You know, for example, where is your initial business capital going to come from? Is it going to come from equity, such as money coming from the owners, or is it going to come from debt, loans? Are you contemplating any mergers with other yeah. companies,
right.
You know, bringing in either new other co-owners or other businesses that you're combining with? What will the role of your owners be? Do you have more than one owner? If so, are the other owners looking to just make a monetary investment, not having any involvement in the business? Are you looking to, again, possibly add additional owners later? How are the owners expecting to be paid? Are they looking for salary as part of the business? Are they going to be working with it? Are they looking for distributions periodically for the business, profits and losses? Are they looking to really have no steady source of income, and they're just looking for a business opportunity that's growing, and then at the end they're able to sell their interest off to someone else and make money? So, you know, there are a lot of different considerations there. Also, you know, how much do you expect the business and its owners to earn from the business? Depending on your answer, there could be different tax brackets that would affect your choice in terms of, you know, is it likely you're going to earn $50,000 a year through the business, or are you going to be in the millions of dollars of business? You know, your tax bracket may be affected through that. So there are many different variables, and because the listeners probably have all different kinds of businesses and potential
Correct.
Ownership structures. I don't want to give a blanket statement as to which one might be better. You really want to talk to an attorney. But those are some of the factors that you'll want to consider. And as you're looking to do that, to possibly form a business entity so that you can, you know, factor in, think about all of those different things to see which one that you, when you speak with an attorney or an accountant to try and form a business entity, which one would be best for you.
See, all the things that Josh just mentioned there, and I know it gets very complicated very quickly, and that's why you want to seek the advice of an attorney. Just like I always say, never do your own taxes. Always get an accountant to look at your tax situation and help you out. I always give that advice and never give, you know, direct advice on accounting because of that. I know a lot of the listeners who are thinking of starting computer repair shops, they're afraid. And they're afraid, and that's why they ask about the LLC. And can you answer what does it do you have to have an attorney to get an LLC?
Not necessarily. I mean, corporations, LLCs are creatures of statute, and so every state has their different filing procedures and things for forming a corporation or an LLC or a partnership. They all have different types of forms that you need to file. They have different types of basic ownership agreements, you know, whether it's a partnership agreement, whether it's a membership agreement for an LLC or an operating agreement or articles of incorporation for a corporation. So there are forms that you have to file. You know, is it absolutely necessary if you're savvy to have an attorney? No, but in terms of selecting what type of entity makes the best sense for you, and then obviously especially if you have more than one person involved in the ownership structure of the business, where you have different, in the case where you have different people who are expecting different things out of the business and what their roles are, then it's a good idea to have an attorney to kind of guide you through that process, and then also to
protect you. I mean, to protect you and looking out for
and to make sure that you know what to do going forward, because it is different, as I said before, from a sole proprietorship, where you know you have to follow those different corporate formalities in terms of keeping, you know, in addition to, you know, keeping your assets separate from your personal assets separate from the business, you need to have frequent meetings at some point to formally make certain decisions on behalf of the business. You can have those monthly, you can have those yearly, whatever, but there has to be some kind of formality with that, and you want to make sure that when you form an entity, you're not just forming it and that's the end of it. You follow that corporate formality to make sure that that you continue to be protected, because in the court, you know, the courts will recognize what are called sham corporations, where mm-hmm. if you don't follow, you know, if you just form a business entity and you're commingling your funds and you're, you know, you are really the business and you're not, there's no separation between you and the company, then they can do what's called piercing the corporate veil, which is, you know, if you picture the Wizard of Oz and you pull back the curtain and there's a wizard there, that's what they'll do, and they'll you know, find that there's potentially a sham corporation, and your assets then would come back into play, because, you know, if there's commingling, it's really you and the company are the same person. So
now, I'm glad you said that. So there's nothing's guaranteed in the world, obviously.
Well, yeah,
there's
there are things that you can and should do. If your goal is to have the separate company, to make sure that to try and reduce your personal risks, that that you continue to follow and make sure that the two are actually separate. So okay. It's not just as simple as just forming the company and that's it. That you have to. I mean, it doesn't have to be particularly onerous all the time. It's not. There's definitely steps that you have to follow. But
Now I know it's not in here, and I don't know if you want to bring this in now, but. Indemnification. First off, what is that? I threw that term out there.
Well, let's talk.
What's that term?
Yeah, let's talk about. I mean, some of the liabilities that were brought up by the listener in the question. I mean, because it'll help, I think, to understand what some of the liabilities are that can face people in the IT industry. Potentially there are a lot of different liabilities facing someone in the computer service and support field. Obviously, intellectual property can be an issue.
Yep.
Depending on what field you're in, if you're providing software to your clients, are you providing or building off of someone else's software? If so, there could be copyright and licensing issues that you need to be aware of. If you're developing a website, again, if you're using or building off of someone else's software or code, there could be copyright and licensing issues. Or if you're designing and developing a website that's similar or identical, or somebody else claims that it's similar or identical to their website, you could have copyright or trademark infringement issues, or issues that would involve laws about consumer confusion. Privacy, obviously, is always a big issue. There have been many laws enacted over the years, in the past 10, 15 years, that require businesses in certain fields to maintain the privacy of information that they keep. Sorry, am I
trying to get you closer?
I'm going back and forth on
this. I know.
This,
so it's, I'm trying to get you closer.
All right. Privacy, there are a lot of laws that require businesses in certain fields to maintain the privacy of information that they keep regarding their customers, their employees, etc. So depending on what types of clients you have and what you're what you're doing for them, you could have issues relating to private
privacy. What if you don't know? Like, if you inherit, like, I don't know if this is too specific, but what if I walk in somewhere and I don't know that that software is legitimate or not? I don't know. I assume it is because I just, and I don't verify. You know what I mean? Like, you could inherit things that are already there that when you bring on a client, because, you know, they didn't start out at the beginning with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, is there, I don't know, does that...
Part of that will depend.
Does that protect you a little bit because you're inheriting some of that?
Well, it could, and it could pose a potential problem because you don't know. Well, first of all, I mean, in terms of what is your role with the client? I mean,
okay,
that's going to be part of you know, what we talk about in a second in terms of defining your contracts and what it is that you want to do, that you want to clarify what it is that you're working on with your client, for your client, and what is
so
included where, in
where's
your
services. Where's my responsibility?
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
And so
if you have a client that you know has issues that they or laws and regulations that they have to follow with respect to privacy issues, then you want to document what it is that you're looking at for the client. You understand what it is you're being brought in to do and things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So privacy obviously is a big issue. There are, you know, a lot of different statutes out there. HIPAA, for example, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which was 1996, which requires people in possession of personal medical information, doctors, hospitals, insurance companies, and as well as employers who have information concerning their employees in terms of, you know, personally identifiable information relating to medical issues and things like that. And then there's the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which is a federal law passed in 1999, which relates to financial institutions and requiring certain information to be protected and safeguarded for financial information's privacy notices, things like that. You've probably seen some of it.
Yes.
You might not be familiar with the name.
The name, Graham, right.
Yeah. But financial institutions is sometimes a broader term than you might normally think and could apply to a variety of different businesses, not just your banks and mortgages. But even if there's not a specific federal statute or law that safeguards against the dissemination of personal and private information in certain fields, there are still a lot of state laws that could apply to the privacy of information. You have identity theft and hacking and computer crime statutes and laws. Clients may have their own personal contractual obligations to their clients in terms of, keeping information about their clients confidential. And then there's always been, common law types of claims for, just invasion of privacy and dissemination of private information to the public. And so privacy is a big concern, obviously.
And two things that I get involved in all the time is FINRA compliance in the financial industry and PCI compliance from the credit card industry. I have clients where for PCI, that's a compliance that you're not allowed to take and hold credit card information or the information or all the parts of a credit card where it's not encrypted, protected. If there's a whole bunch of regulations that you must do the due diligence to prove that you are protected, and you got to test that. And I've had to help clients with that just so they can be certified to be able to take credit cards because they can't have, they can only like store the last four digits. They can't have the name and the full number in a particular place without it being specifically encrypted within the software. So this way, no one could get to it. But I think the point here is that know the industry that you're trying to support. Get an understanding of the compliance issues so you can then be prepared to help do what you do in the computer field, whether it be, you're doing their IT support or whatever. You know that you got to To get real specific, you know, the wireless has to be locked down. There has to be, you know, there's many, many things. If you even query PCI compliance, there's a one. There's like it's like 27 pages of questions that a company based on their size has to answer to be compliant. And if you ever take a look at these are public information. If you ever take a look at one of them from an IT perspective, you'll see what I mean. Where they get pretty specific on each of the areas in the IT. So the same with like HIPAA in the
Grammarly.
Yeah, your any kind of personal information. I've had to sign.
Part of it's going to depend too on what your services are. I mean, are you brought in you know on a one time basis to work on a couple computers, or are you going to be brought in as their overall IT person? Okay. Are you in charge of maintaining you know data privacy? You know, is it just internet? You know, abilities, you know, telecommunications, things like that, and you know, definitely the more you know about what your client does and what the issues are that they have, the better. But particularly so if you're involved in some way in dealing with the you know the data privacy and things like that.
And someone before, and I'll get to this after the show, asked me, and the reason why I'm bringing that up is they were asking what shows I've talked about doing change control. That's one very tiny aspect of what I do to make sure that I'm going through a process that I am documenting any kind of change to kind of cover everything I'm doing and also protect my clients. And I go through a very detailed change control process because when you introduce change, you got to make sure there's certain things you got to do and follow and test and make sure. And involved in any kind of compliance, that's just one little aspect as part of the requirements as we kind of, you know, bring it to the IT. Something else, when you mentioned all this, all the clients, all the types of industries, I've had to sign many, many non-disclosure agreements with all my clients mm-hmm. where I am signing that I am going to protect their data and not protect their data so much as I'm not allowed to share it.
Yeah, if you come across access to their sensitive information, then you're not going to divulge it to a third
exactly.
party.
Yeah. Exactly, especially all my my listeners know because I don't mention them specifically, but I talk about a lot of issues with financial advisors because that's I do a lot of consulting for them, and you know each one of them that's required that you know because I'm looking at very sensitive information sometimes, just like attorneys. There were cases that I had of there
I've
was
had many
files
cases.
That I they were lost that were part of a case that I had to recover from a damaged server that they were trying to find actual you know detailed files, and so that got very hairy.
I'm glad you brought that up because we've been talking about privacy information for you know the client's clients, but I've had a lot of cases involving just you know general businesses where you know they have their own sensitive information, proprietary information, trade secrets that you know distinguish them from their competitors, and obviously data security and security regarding the businesses. Overall information, their client lists, customer lists, vendors, all that different stuff is extremely important, especially in the way it's compiled sometimes. And so businesses can be protective of that. And so, it is common in many instances for businesses to try and preserve that confidentiality so that when somebody comes in and you know does any work that has access to that, even if it's necessary, they will sometimes be asked to sign a non-disclosure agreement for or a confidentiality agreement to make sure that it remains that way.
And be careful because take a good look that's why attorneys exist and have an attorney possibly review complicated ones because I have a consultant who's a listener who did not take a client because the confidentiality agreement specified he wasn't allowed to work on anybody like his industry and for a period of time he was exclusive for that industry mm-hmm. and I was like a non-compete, almost like you would have as an employee you know, and yet they made contractors do that, and by the very nature of him signing that he would not be able to work on other people similar to that industry, and he couldn't do it. And so, you know, you had to walk away, you know, from that client. And I was like, wow. So my antennas went up because I was like, I got to be careful of that myself. You know, that's why you got to read everything. You don't want to sign something and agree to something that you don't fully understand, and then you're breaking the agreement because you didn't fully understand it. That's not good enough. You signed it. So that's why you want to, you know, you hire someone like Josh to review it with you to protect you. And he may advise, don't sign it, or you would advise recommendations maybe to make changes.
Or you could try and negotiate certain things that if something is written in the agreement that's very broad or doesn't seem to be necessary to the agreement, or you may have concerns about how specific words are written or clauses or phrases.
And they may like that because they may be in there. Because it could be a company that doesn't even realize, and they're using an employment agreement as opposed to developing one for contractors, you know, a separate one, which, you know, maybe that issue would be excluded.
And a lot of times, whether or not you sign the agreement, I guess, is going to depend on the type of client that you have in terms of, are you looking to just do one minor thing for them? Or are you looking to be their, you know, is this going to be your best client and you don't have, this is your, essentially the in-house person, the IT person that they're going to have, and you don't anticipate going in working for different competitors, things like that. So it's going to be, you know, balancing test in terms of, you know, what kind of agreement are you looking to, are you willing to have?
It is. And one of the things that I know we talk a lot about retainer clients where I want to be for my clients the full and exclusive IT support for all of their IT needs. So I'm responsible for their data security, their upgrades, their systems, I want to be their IT support of a small business that can't afford to bring on full-time support. And that's my, you know, home run client, so to speak. And I even just having conversations with Josh, my life got more complicated because I started looking at my own contracts and I'm not specific enough in things. You got me to think as I'm looking at the areas, I don't specify, I'm too general in too many areas and I'm not specific enough. And, you know, it's even got me to relook at that.
Yeah, let's. I don't want to forget some of the other areas of liability. One is obviously data preservation issues. Sometimes, if you're brought in to help a client, make sure that they have backups and things like that. And I saw one question come up earlier in terms of having a paper trail, and you touched upon that as well. There are times where you may recommend something to a client that they don't follow. It certainly never hurts to have a paper trail of that kind of thing to make sure that...
Well, that's why save emails, like especially if they're responding. If you make a recommendation and send it by email, I mean, do you recommend just, you know, keeping that as a trail? Is that a good enough trail? Like the response of someone's email to me stating, you know, you should be doing this, my recommendations, and then they respond, and I keep that response.
Never hurts because, if you don't have a paper trail, then, you know, essentially if there's a dispute that arises, it's one person's word against another as to who said what and what exactly was said. And so whenever you're dealing with that situation, it's always harder to go back and prove, especially if the other person denies it. And, you never know what's going to happen in terms of that. So, but in terms of, going back to the original question, which is trying to protect yourself from liabilities, obviously, number one is don't do anything wrong.
That's easier said than done, but
yep. Obviously things happen.
Yeah, accidents happen.
No one's perfect, and even if you are, sometimes things can still go wrong and that kind of stuff. But one way to try and help that is to clarify. We've been talking about contracts, and one of the things you can do is to clarify with your clients exactly what you're responsible for, what you're not responsible for, and the way you do that to try and clarify that is to have written contract that clearly states the terms of your agreement. I've had many cases, whether or not they're involved involved in the IT field or outside of it involving contracts. And the more common issues that usually arise are, one, when there's just no written contract whatsoever and you're dealing with verbal discussions or occasional emails to establish the contract, or if you're dealing with an unspecific or a poorly drafted contract, which doesn't account for all the different variables in terms of what's included, what's not included in the agreement. The first situation where there's no contract and you're dealing with verbal discussions or various emails that maybe touch upon certain terms is often the most difficult kind of contract case because, as we mentioned, it's subject to one person's word against another, where there's not a written contract signed by both parties. Not only have you show that the other party is in breach of the contract, but you have to show that a contract even existed in the first place and what the terms of the contract were. And I've had cases involving verbal contracts, and they're certainly more difficult to prove, especially where you have one party who just out and out denies that a contract even existed in the beginning. So depending on the...
Speaking of verbal, I'm going to take us off on tangent. Sorry about this. You got me thinking of something. Is there any kind of implied contracts that are reasonable based on, okay, maybe I don't have something signed, but I become their regular support on a regular basis, which could be proved by the amount of time I'm spending and what I am doing?
It can depend on the state. It can depend on the type of contractors, goods or services that you're providing.
Is there a dollar value that there's a dollar value between verbal and written, or
there could be. I mean, if there's a uniform commercial code which is in place in many states where they do have there's a statute of frauds which is basically it has to be in writing if it's a contract involving goods or services, or if it has certain dollar amount. In some states, I think under the old UCC it was $500. Other states,
right,
it's like $5,000 now. So there, in your more traditional contracts, real estate transactions, for instance, always have to be in writing. At least in Pennsylvania, most states, I would imagine it's the same thing. But depending on the type of property, the type of goods or services that you have, you'll have to have a written contract. Others, you could have potentially verbal contracts and that kind of thing. It's going to depend on what exactly is at issue in the case. But once you have at least something documented in writing, it's important, obviously, to have the terms of the contract written down that are clearly specified. Mike and I were talking before the show about never assume anything.
Oh yeah.
Because what you assume and what somebody else assumes, or even if you haven't even think about it, nobody has even thought about a possible outcome, it can completely change the situation. It could be two entirely different things in terms of what one person's thinking, what the other person's thinking. And so, don't go into specifics.
I'm not going to get into specifics, right.
But a good rule of thumb is don't assume anything, and you want to make sure that, especially the key terms of your contract are put into writing. So
I got to share something that the lessons that I continually learn this lesson over and over again. You can never be detailed enough. You specify as much as you can and be as clear as possible, because that's what gets, I know if I run into problems, that's where it's normally where there's a dispute on our interpretations of what we thought, for the goods or services that were supposed to be delivered versus what I thought should be, and this is certainly even outside the IT area, but they thought something, I thought something, and it's because we didn't put it down in writing to be specific enough.
Sometimes it's almost impossible to include every possible scenario or outcome that could happen. I mean, earthquakes and hurricanes and things like that, which we've had in Pennsylvania last month, things like that you never think of, but, it happens. And, so are you able to always say exactly what happens in a given scenario? Not necessarily, but you can put in clear and unambiguous terms what what the big issues are that potentially could arise, and make sure that something is going to be in the contract about that. And some of the things, obviously, we talked about scope of work is a big thing. It's going to depend on the products or services that your business is agreeing to provide. Are you going to provide a one-time service? Are you going to be there someone's on-call technician? What's the scope of what you're going to work work on for your client? Are you advising them on their entire system? Are you only providing maintenance services for, you know, specific computers or hardware and software, phones, printers, email accounts? Are you involved in the website? Are you going to provide them with specific products, computers, hardware, software, or are you simply recommending them? Does the scope of your work include advising them on data security or data security for their clients? Do they have, or is part of your work in ensuring that they have proper backups? Are you providing any guarantees or warranties as to the duration or the effectiveness of the systems they have in place? If you're providing your customers with software or website, what are the party? This is a big one. You know, sometimes the party. What are the party's rights at the end of the contract to that? In terms of, you know, if you're developing a website or software for a client, who has the right to that once the contract is over? Is it something that you've developed to use with many clients, or is it specifically limited to this one that they get the property after it's finished? So, you know, who owns the technology when the contract is over could be a big thing. Obviously, another significant issue that everyone would be aware of is payment in your contract. You know, sometimes it's not an easy answer in terms of payment, depending on your situation. Are you asking for are you doing a one-time service and therefore a one-time payment? Or are you going to be someone's on-call person? Are you going to have you know, monthly payments or only payments when you perform services? When are the payments due? How much?
I'm very specific when it comes to payments.
I would imagine the contractor is usually tries to make this a little clearer. So, but sometimes it's not a simple answer, and so you want to, you know, communicate that in the contract. And then we talked about obviously what happens if you give advice that they don't follow. Are they declining your recommendations? It never hurts to confirm those decisions in writing, either in the contract or in a letter or email later, to help protect yourself. And you can also input in the agreement what happens in the event that one of the parties breaches the contract. For example, if you have a client who stops paying, at what point can you stop providing services? Who owns the property, obviously? If the client never pays, if you develop a website or something like that, if you provide them with you know, with hardware or software, who owns that property once it's installed? If you breach the contract, what are your client's rights? Sometimes you can include what's called a liquidated damages provision, which, you know, limits the amount of your exposure to the amount that's been paid under the contract. As opposed to unlimited damages. Do you have the ability to cure any defects? We were also talking about this beforehand in a different context. But, you know, if they say that you did something wrong or haven't done something yet, do you have the ability and time to try and correct the defect? And they have to provide you with notice to give you that opportunity. And then just general types of business issues that you can put in a contract is, you know, if you're in Pennsylvania and you have a client in California, if there's a dispute, where are you going to litigate a claim? Are you going to litigate it in Pennsylvania, or do you got to go to California when there's an issue? What state's law is going to apply? Because sometimes there's going to be different laws that apply.
It's funny you, boy, you could be here for 5 hours. Yeah. But wait, when you brought that up, you made me think of contracts that I was involved in when I was the network manager for a large company, and I'm thinking companies like HP, Dell, Xerox. Their contracts, when, you know, literally stated what state that they would, you know, because,
that's right.
You know, and, you know, what Josh has just said, I've actually been involved in contracts just from a position of being a manager, because I'm dealing with large contractors and I get involved. And that's why we had a legal department that would review that and review all contracts. I was not allowed to sign a contract unless it was reviewed by legal. And they would, you know, make some changes, and, you know, we would be months sometimes back and forth for sometimes just a simple maintenance agreement for some equipment. And we were 3 months going back and forth on the attorneys, you know, dot the I's, crossing the T's. It just, you know, it was funny. A quick, I have to just a quick story. There was a big company that I was with had a legal department that they just felt, well, they have to make a change to kind of justify themselves, and there would always be some kind of a change. Well, when it came time to the agreement for our spam filtering software, which this one particular attorney was being crushed. A matter of fact, he was one of the people that brought this up because we didn't have a spam filtering service, and he was being just bombarded. And what was so funny, that agreement was turned around faster than any agreement that I ever had. I had it back in minutes, and I was like, "We're not editing anything today." And he's like, "We want this right away." And it's like, that's what I was like, "Okay." So like, it went boom right out. I was like, "Anyway, I'm just sorry. I'm just it made me think of that."
When you talked about going back and forth with the party, I mean, that kind of drives home the point that a lot of these things are negotiable between the contractor and the client, and there's a lot of things that you can put into a contract, and sometimes you'll have to negotiate, sometimes the other party will accept what you have in the contract, but if it's not in there, then in some respect, then you're leaving it up for interpretation by not only you, but also by the other person, and then up to the court. I mean, sometimes if there's something that's not in the agreement, then, if it's not spelled out, then you could have a potential dispute and all kinds of lack of clarity to address with that later.
We covered many questions just on that whole, as we were doing it. But let's get to some others here you want to get to.
You had mentioned indemnification before as well, too. Yes. That's another thing that you can include in an agreement, which talks about who's liable for certain things. Hopefully in your agreement you've said something about the scope of your work, and that may in many instances drive what in the indemnification provision. And for those of you who aren't familiar, indemnification is basically a contractual agreement that states who's liable, usually either you or your client, to a third party if that third party asserts a claim out of something that you've worked on or have touched on in your business. Sometimes an agreement will require the contractor, the IT person, to indemnify and defend their client if the client is sued by a third party for something that happened. A privacy issue would be, a good example of something like that. If somebody says that the client, divulged in private sensitive information and it got out there, and then they sue both you and your client. Indemnification provision might say that if the client is sued, the contractor would basically step in the shoes of the client in the lawsuit. The contractor would pay the cost of hiring an attorney to defend the lawsuit. The contractor would pay any judgment or settlement for the amount of the claim that has to be paid. Vice versa, if the client agrees to defend and indemnify the contractor, then the client would stand in the shoes of the IT person, and the contractor, if they're sued by a third party for something that went wrong, the client would then pay the cost of defending the lawsuit and step in the shoes of the IT person and pay settlement or judgment. It's similar to an insurance policy, in which case you have an insurance company that if you're sued for, if you get in an auto accident or something, the insurance, and you get sued as allegedly liable for the accident, your insurance company will appoint an attorney and they'll defend and pay a judgment up to a certain amount.
How good if I put a paragraph in there that I'm responsible for nothing and they can do nothing? And they signed this agreement, and I have, a pretty basic paragraph that just lets me off the hook. That doesn't totally let me off the hook, because there could be scenarios where they could still, sue me.
Well, there's never a guarantee that you'll have no involvement in the lawsuit whatsoever. Right. I mean, you could be sued, and then you have as a separate issue, your client has the obligation to defend and indemnify you in the case, and which case we'll have to see what the client does. Hopefully the client, there could be issues potentially. What if the client is bankrupt or no longer around? They can't pay for, then you're kind of stuck in that situation. But sometimes they'll see the contract, they'll agree to it and that kind of thing. But it's a lot of times it's another matter of negotiation for contracts. Sometimes one party will agree to indemnify the other. Sometimes they'll agree to indemnify them for nothing. Sometimes you'll have some kind of blended agreement where, for instances where you have a specifically defined scope of work, the contractor will agree to stand behind the terms of what they've done, and they'll agree to indemnify the other, and then the client will indemnify them for everything else. So you may have some kind of blended indemnification provision in that as well. So,
all right.
And then in terms of, you know, one last thing in terms of managing risk. We haven't talked about insurance. There's obviously things you can do to help protect yourself against the risks that the business faces, which is insurance. The purpose of insurance, many states have different types of insurance policies, and obviously you'd want to talk to a local insurance agent to determine which types of coverages are available to you depending on what types of services you provide. Typically, a standard auto or homeowner's insurance policy wouldn't cover you in your business. But there are usually, in most states, at least two types of insurance that would usually apply to people in computer support. The first type of insurance, you'd have a general commercial liability policy, or GCL. Those types of policies typically cover the business from claims of general negligence, bodily injury or property damage. If you personally injure somebody or negligently cause damage to their computer systems or property, that kind of thing. And also, usually those policies include personal or advertising injury, which could include claims of intellectual property issues, copyright, trademark, things like that.
And here's also a plug for business insurance. Something that I didn't think of, but obviously, it was an insurance person who brought this up. My homeowner's policy and my auto policy would not cover transporting or having computers or equipment that were part of my business that were for another client. That, let's say I was in a car accident and there was computers that I was transporting. It wouldn't be covered in my auto policy unless I had coverage with business insurance. Another one. And it made me think of this because I work on servers and they could be expensive. And what if I had some expensive equipment here in the house and God forbid something happened? My homeowners would not cover that. And so,
yeah, many times in these policies, auto and homeowners insurance are specific exclusions that would say something to the effect that, this does not, the property that is used for business purposes or, while you're driving a car in the operation of your business or something like that. Actually, that might be covered in terms of auto insurance. But, there are specific exclusions there for, business property and things. And so as we're talking about liability insurance, I mean, obviously you'd want to, if you have a lot of business property, whether you have your own building, specifically for your business, where I would imagine you have a lot of computers and screens and different things, servers you might have, you'd want to make sure that you get regular property insurance for those as well, to cover in the event of fire, theft, some kind of other damage, water damage. And then you can turn to other different types of policies. Another main type of liability insurance is errors and omissions, or an E&O policy. That's basically your professional liability or malpractice insurance. It's usually available for people and businesses that give advice, make recommendations, design solutions, and represent others. I mean, there's all different types of E&O insurance depending on your profession. I mean, lawyers have malpractice insurance, doctors, computer IT people have different needs as well that could be covered under an E&O policy. And the E&O policy is for errors when you do something you shouldn't have done, or omissions where you failed to do something that you should have done. So you'll obviously want to understand when you're getting an insurance policy, who's covered under the policy by way of the named insurers. Is it named insured? Is it just the business? Is it all the employees and officers and owners? And so you want to make sure that you talk to your insurance agent about that kind of thing. And if anyone in Pennsylvania needs one, Mike and I know a good insurance agent, so feel free to contact either one of us. So, but there may be additional policies that you might want to consider depending on your business and the state you're in. For instance, if you have employees, and you might want to consider employment practices liability insurance. You may have a need for workers' compensation or unemployment compensation insurance. If you have a more complex ownership structure, there's directors and officers insurance, and so there's a lot of different types of policies that you can have, but those were the primary two. So,
all right, where are we at on questions? Is there another? Let's do the next one.
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, as a system,
sorry, that took about 40 minutes to answer that first question, because there was a lot at issue in that. So I think that took care of a lot of the other questions we had.
Yeah, it did. It actually did. Yeah. Here's one. As a systems admin, I have access to vast amounts of private data for both home and business users. Since I have multiple medical, insurance, and accounting clients, their data may be required to be encrypted for various compliance issues. We kind of touched on this. As a provider of some cloud services, I store end-user data in encrypted form in a data center as well. Wow, that puts you in a different category there. Can I be required to provide access to the server stored key files, which decrypt data, or the backup passwords? What level of protection do I have from civil action from a party which may be injured if the data which by law had to be encrypted became disclosed and the disclosure came from me providing those passwords or key files?
Good question. Second question. I mean, obviously, without knowing some more of the facts, there could be some issues involved that, you know, I don't want to give what I can do is give a general background as to what types of legal issues are involved in that. And I could probably talk for another hour on discovery and civil lawsuits, and especially with regard to production of documents and information that's stored electronically, which in, I don't know if you guys call it ESI. That's what we call it in litigation, electronically stored information, ESI. But, you know, generally in lawsuits, a party is entitled to ask another party, you know, plaintiff or defendant, to provide relevant documents within their control. And that process of gathering information and documentation in lawsuits is called discovery.
That's like Google, giving out information if they were subpoenaed for data on someone.
And that's the third thing. I mean, if somebody is being asked for information and they're not a party to the lawsuit, they're not a plaintiff or a defendant, you can still try and get that information, and you do that by way of having a subpoena issued.
Right.
And so, you know, 20 years ago, you know, documents would be produced by going into your filing cabinet, pulling out some documents, making some copies, and sending them to the other side. Now discovery is much, much more complicated because everyone or most businesses store all of their information and documents electronically. And not only that, most people conduct business nowadays and communicate internally and externally via email rather than by telephone or in person. And so there's much, much more documentation that can be compiled in the case. And you can imagine how much you guys know more than I in terms of how much information is stored electronically.
Yeah.
You have and how much of that is probably not even relevant to a case. But so the challenge and the expenses in gathering and reviewing all that information to produce what's relevant.
Think of what social media has done to that.
Well, and that's another step too. I mean, normally you have documents and information that's stored on your internal services, but now you have third parties such as, you know, Facebook and
Twitter.
Those are starting to come out as well too in terms of third parties having control of that information and what's relevant and, you know, privacy issues and all that kind of stuff. So so discovery has become much, much more complicated. Generally in litigation, a party is obligated to review and produce its own documents in ESI. And many times, I speak from personal experience, a lawyer collaborates with the client's IT specialist to find out where is the information stored, how's it stored, and, you know, especially an issue, how do we go about preserving the information from destruction and deletion, and you have automatic
electronic
deletion policies.
Electronic hold on data.
Litigation hold letters, things like that, and suspending those policies. And then how do you go about actually accessing the information, imaging things, basically getting the documents ready for the attorneys or the client to review and produce what's left. So a company's IT specialist can be very important.
I spent about 25% of my time on that very area when I was a network manager because of the lawsuits that were involved, that I was always given that, you know, this is our backup policy, this is what we do, and then there would be, we even had a process internally that would trigger that electronic hold, that that we had that trigger that then the whole staff and everybody that was involved in the network team would know, okay, these tapes from this moment cannot be overwritten, or this data now has to be put at a separate place, you know, for that information. And it may or may not have been required to use, but at that moment we had to start the whole process. And it was very... So, you know, it could get time-consuming. I mean, it was, you know,
This kind of discovery is, obviously, it's one of the, I think, bigger issues with lawsuits and litigation right now in terms of the amount of data that's there and the expense and time of trying to go through and sift all that, not just, you know, preserving the data, but then culling it and going through it to find what's relevant. So, I mean, but, you know, speaking as a lawyer, I know IT people who have who do the work for the clients can be very important when you're trying to call that information, because a lot of clients, depending on their sophistication with computers, sometimes many clients don't have their own internal people. They hire outside right. people to, you know, to kind of manage their IT systems and data preservation. And so so that role can be an important one in litigation. And so,
Even as a client, one of my clients was involved in litigation that I had to provide access to information, and I even helped them, and it was actually data that was backed up prior to me even being coming on board. So the backups all changed when I was there, and it was very easy for me to get, but data that was different, you know, that was backed up another way, and they no longer had access to that IT person, and that was where the lawsuit generated from. But I had to assist to do what I could do to help them, you know, and where it was kind of a fascinating process. It was actually last summer and that I went through for the detail that, you know, there was some, I was going to say some significant billable hours on my time just to try to
yeah,
help,
I believe
you know,
it, yeah.
it was, you know, and so, I don't mind because, you know, as long as you do the best job you can, you take pride in what you're doing and you do everything to the best of your ability that, you know, in your area of expertise, then you're not going to have anything to worry about, and just keep, you know, I always promote, you know, be honest, be straightforward, work hard, and, you know, and it's always easier to go back and, you know, document, backup, and it's how you protect you, your client, everybody. Yeah. You know?
And as to your specific question, I mean, in terms of when do you have to hand over, you know, passwords and information, I think the answer is going to depend on who's asking for the information and in what context. I mean, if you're ever in doubt, obviously you'd want to talk to a lawyer and your client to make sure that they're aware of the situation. I mean, I would assume that you're not talking about just sending it to somebody who has no connection or access or right to that information or giving it to the general public. But if you're providing the information, the passwords, or access to the server to the client only, the first place I would probably look at is what are the terms of your contract or your relationship with your client. Mm. Does your client have the right to access the confidential information and have the right to the passwords and key files? If so, there may not be an issue, you know, in terms of you providing them with that information. Now, if you're being asked to provide that information to someone other than your client, you could be potentially forced to provide the information through a subpoena issued by the court, which we talked about. But
now, if it's a subpoena, I have to. Well, this is silly. I don't know. And tell me if we can't answer this. Do I have to obey? I have to obey a subpoena.
Yeah, subpoena is an order of court, and so I mean, there are ways to if you're not sure about the scope of the subpoena, or you know, you have objections to the subpoena,
a little bit,
there are procedures available that you could file a motion with the court. Obviously, if. Well,
because the scope may be too big or too expensive or too, you know, costly.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that the court looks at in terms of burden, you know, financial and just the time commitment and things like that. There's also issues in terms of the relevancy of the information. Now, typically, you know, a third party usually wouldn't subpoena another party for the passwords and information. They would just basically, I've seen subpoenas where they've been asked to provide their entire computer system or all of their information.
Right.
So usually in that kind of situation, it's very broad. And so there, if you as a third party to a case receive a subpoena, obviously the first step would be making sure your client is aware of the situation, so that the client who's in the best position to make a decision as to what is relevant or not in a case, they could be, you know, they could take the procedural steps by filing some kind of motion in the court in terms of either challenging, and not to say you wouldn't be involved in that process. You may also want to file some kind of a motion with the court relating to that. But
you need to get an attorney. If you get a subpoena, you really should review that.
You should make sure that if you're not sure the person's entitled to it and you've got privacy issues and things like that, that you could be on the hook. I mean, you probably want to speak with an attorney to make sure the other side is entitled to the information they're seeking. If it's a client, if it's something that's, you know, squarely in the contract and the client is demanding it, then
look at your.
I mean, not to say you should never look, you know, hire an attorney, because you don't. I mean, but if there's any lack of clarity, you'd want to make sure that you do consider that. So
I like that. I mean, lack of clarity. That's a great...
Well, if, yeah, if there's a contract, I mean, this situation seems to be where, you know, the client would... I mean, assuming that the client would have normally the right to keep passwords and things like that. And so, you know, there may not be an issue in terms of giving the client the passwords. But if there's a third party, then, you know, we were talking about some of the motions. Sometimes the court will, when there's a motion filed, the court may limit the scope of the discovery that's being sought. You know, they'll say that they're entitled. Sometimes the subpoena is very broadly written, and what the other side is asking for is not actually the confidential information. They just want certain things, and so you want to get clarity on that. Sometimes they do want the information, and then you've got a bigger battle in terms of trying to prove what's relevant in the case, what isn't, what should be produced, what shouldn't. You know, sometimes if there's confidential information, you can ask the court or the parties can enter into what's called a confidentiality agreement or a protective order, where it's spelled out that if certain information is produced in the case, would basically decide both parties are limited in terms of what they can do with the information and what they can't do.
So I was just going to, and it's just to be a little more general than the question that's in the chat. If by court order I give information and it's now out of my control, if they do something bad with that data, that's on them. That's not on me.
Who's the they?
The third party. The third party, you know, what if they took the data and did something? I think
I'd feel better if there's a court order that says you have to produce these passwords or key files,
and you turn them over,
and there's a confidentiality agreement,
and the other side takes
that information and uses that, then I would, you know, I would certainly take the position it's on them.
Yeah, that would be right. You know, so I mean, well, without getting specific, but you know, I mean, I know there's a lot of detail.
If you're under a court order to provide it, then you know, obviously.
Yeah, and I would think, and I would hope that would be your protection. But it doesn't exclude the fact that everybody can sue everybody, and then the courts sort it all out, and then that's what would happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's no guarantee. I mean, I've seen some lawsuits in my day that don't seem to have any merit. So you never know what potentially you could get sued for. But you know, so
yep. Well, I know I told Josh we would be an hour, and we're a little over an hour, and I don't mind going long on special shows. That we got several more hours. Let's keep going.
There was one more question that I wanted. I saw there was a copyright question that we had before as well.
And just the third one here, right?
Yeah, because we haven't really touched on that.
So. Here we go. What liability could I be exposed to as a computer consultant if a client uses pirated software? Is there a difference if I did not install the pirated software and I would hypothetically be installing patches to that pirated software?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'd probably want to know some of the more of the facts, especially with the, you know, what are the patches and the et cetera that he has at the end of the question.
Well,
terms of what is actually being done with the patches. But I mean, obviously, many times software is copyrighted, and so in those situations, it'd be subject to the copyright laws. Owners of a copyright have the exclusive right to reproduce the work, to distribute the work, and to prepare derivative works based on the copyrighted work. So we'd have to discuss the patches that you'd be installing and how they're being installed. But, you know, to the extent that you're reproducing, distributing, or preparing derivative works based on originally copyrighted material, then potentially, you know, if you're doing it without permission or a license, then there could be issues. And so you'd want to have, you know, serious discussions with your client. Sometimes, you know, it's just a matter of paying a licensing fee of a couple hundred dollars or something like that, which, you know, when faced with the prospect of years of litigation and attorney's fees and potential damages and punitive damages, things like that.
So what's the advice? Once I know it's pirated, confront the client and try to have them make it right before you continue doing any work to it.
I don't want to give specific advice on.
I know,
online, but
I'm just
in
I'm
terms
gonna,
of
in
yeah.
General.
I mean, yeah, you should be aware of that and then discuss it with the client. Make sure that you understand the what's exactly involved and try and work it out. And obviously, if you're ever in doubt in terms of what potential risks are there, if you take steps, then you want to talk to a lawyer to make sure before you do anything.
It's now time to wrap up, and oh boy, there's so many issues that could take hours and hours and literally courses.
There really are. I mean, yeah. I mean, you could break any one of the issues that we talked about and talk, do an hour on each one of those. I mean, you know, I could talk for forever on a lot of this stuff. So
yeah, but yeah. Josh, I had a great time. I hope you did. Really enjoyed having you here. Outline, you know, some answers here to some of my listeners' questions, where I know it gets very complicated very quick, and that's why I think the main point of this, to protect yourself, that's why attorneys exist, and you need them to uncomplicate everything by breaking it down and helping you out, whether it be the details of a contract, whether it be in response to a lawsuit, or if you're given a subpoena.
I couldn't give like specific answers to a lot of the questions. I mean, I hope what I was able to do was to provide at least a general background in terms of what the potential issues are, so that you're at least aware of those and can decide whether you do have an issue and whether you need to address it and that kind of thing. So,
yep.
But I really appreciate the opportunity to do this today, and I want to thank you as well, Mike.
All right. Well, thank you for coming out, and I'm really glad to have you here. And with that, everybody, I want to thank you so very much for downloading and subscribing and listening to the show. And please don't forget to continue to use my Amazon link. If you ever buy anything from Amazon, or you know friends or anybody that is in, you know, that you know uses Amazon, send them to my website, MikeNation.net, MikeTechShow.com, and use my Amazon link. And don't forget, we have shortcuts now. Amazon.MikeNation.net will take you right there. And also MikeTechShow.com/Amazon. And you can purchase from Amazon and support the show. Thank you very much. And we'll be back regular time, same channel, on Thursday night, 8 o'clock. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.